This is the first in our three-part Chautauqua series, during which we'll be bringing to you the voices of some of the leading figures in American history. We begin the series with the author of the Declaration of Independence and former President Thomas Jefferson. Welcome, Mr. President.
Thank you.
First, congratulations on your retirement from the American presidency this year. You must be looking forward to a well-deserved rest, or at least a break from government service, and to your return to your much-beloved Monticello. But let me ask you immediately, what's your assessment of your presidency? What were your greatest accomplishments?
Well, first let me say I retire voluntarily after two terms, believing strongly in rotation in office. And I think I've now set in stone a two-term limit. George Washington, of course, began it by insisting upon retirement after two terms. Adams was a one-term president. I've now insisted upon being no more than a two-term president, even though I think would have been reelected. And I think no president will ever dare stand for a third term, thanks to this precedent by the founding fathers. I would assess my presidency as moderately successful. Very successful in the most important regard. I reduced the national debt by 37%. I consider Alexander Hamilton's national debt to be a national disgrace, and I came into office in 1801 expecting to do everything I could to produce the most frugal administration possible, and I have done it.
What about the Louisiana Purchase?
That was an accident, of course. It was a fugitive occurrence. It was a gift by Napoleon Bonaparte, and I cannot take any credit for it. In fact, I sent ministers to Paris to buy New Orleans and possibly the Floridas, and Napoleon, in a counteroffer, provided us the option of purchasing all of the Louisiana territory for $15.6 million. I can hardly take credit for something that came out of his own sense of desperate need for money to prosecute his wars of expansion in Europe. But I'm delighted, let me say.
Any disappointments?
Well, the chief disappointment is that I didn't rein in the judiciary quite as much as I had hoped. I'm frightened of a runaway judiciary. I think the independency of judges is a mistake in a republic like ours. But also, of course, the embargo. I avoided war with Britain, but the cost of it was huge. And I had the problem in 1807 of either having to surrender to Britain or to fight a war with Britain or to find a middle ground. And, of course, surrender is an impossibility for a sovereign nation like ours. But as a pacifist, at least in theory, I wanted to avoid war if possible. I didn't think we were ready for a war under any circumstance. And so I attempted an economic experiment, a total embargo of goods to and from our ports. And it would have succeeded, I think, if we had kept it for a little while longer. But democracies are impatient of embargoes. There was widespread smuggling, particularly in the New England states. And one of the last acts of my presidency was to sign the repeal of the embargo, which I consider to be a mistake.
People will remember your presidency, but you're clearly going to be best known for your role in marshaling the support for independence and then your leading role in writing the Declaration of Independence. What are your thoughts after these years and your involvement?
Well, I would say that I played smaller a role in the marshaling of independence. That I would give to John Adams and Samuel Adams, but a very large role, of course, in articulating the philosophy of natural rights. I was 33 years old, the youngest member of the Virginia delegation to the Continental Congress. I had been an alternate at the first Continental Congress and a regular constituent in the second. And I arrived back in Philadelphia in May of 1776, just in time to be given the assignment to write the Declaration of Independence. I wrote it in a single day, revised it for a couple of weeks, submitted it to the review of Dr. Franklin, the greatest American, and John Adams, and then we submitted it as a committee to the Congress of the United States. They reduced my draft by one quarter. They mangled it, in my view, and took out a very important anti-slavery manifesto that had been in the original draft. For the rest of my life, I circulated my own draft, and I think it's actually preferable to the one that was promulgated by Congress. But I will say this to you in all candor. If the great men of the Congress in 1776 had known that this document would go on to become one of the great documents in human history and the formative document of the American Republic, I would not have received the assignment. I was a junior member. I had not played a significant role in the Revolution up to that time, and men of much greater ambition than I would have insisted upon that glory if they had known that the Declaration of Independence would become so central to our national philosophy.
Now, you made reference to your partners in this, and you labeled Franklin a great American, but then you just sort of mentioned in passing John Adams. We know your relations with Mr. Adams have not been good as of late. Would you care to comment on that?
Well, there's some chance that we will reconcile in the future. We can't promise that, of course, but I haven't seen him since before my inauguration. You know, he snubbed me in the greatest presidential snub of our time. He left Washington City at dawn on the 4th of March, 1801, refused to stay to see me inaugurated in his place. He was bitter that the American people had retired him after a single term. He blamed me, in some part at least. And so he refused to cooperate, and in the last days of his administration, he appointed a number of people to life-tenured positions who were sworn enemies of me and my political philosophy. So I hold some small feeling of disappointment about Citizen Adams, but he's a dear friend of mine, and he saved this country from war in 1798 by sending a second group of diplomats to Paris. He's a very deep thinker and an ardent Republican. I'm afraid his New England Calvinism has soured his character to a certain extent, but I do love the man, and I hope at some point we will reconcile.
Explain that a bit, his New England Calvinism. What did you mean by that?
Well, I wrote a famous letter about environment, and environment in my day meant something a little bit different from what it would later become in American history. But what I mean is that we are shaped by the place we grow up in, and New Englanders are honest, but they are cold-hearted, and the Calvinism in their temperament renders them ungenerous as human beings. Calvin's, of course, idiotic notion that humans are predestined to damnation, except for a tiny few who are capriciously predestined to salvation, is the most outrageous affront to the dignity of man in human history. He even goes farther than Augustine, who went too far on this question. So I spoke of the maniac ravings of Calvin, and all New Englanders, to one degree or another, are beset by this this foolish notion that humans are inherently flawed.
Now, you defeated him in the election of 1800, but it turned out to be a very peculiar election in that you ended up with a tie with Aaron Burr and had to go into the House and be resolved there. What are your thoughts on that election now that it's, of course, been settled and it's nearly a decade old?
Well, first of all, we need a constitutional amendment to separate the balloting for president and vice president, because everyone knew that I was the president of the United States, that I had been elected and that Burr was my vice president. But because of the quirk of the Electoral College system, we tied, and that put the election into the House of Representatives. The House of Representatives that sat in judgment of the election was a lame duck Federalist, outgoing, anti-Republican House of Representatives, and they actually toyed with a constitutional junta to supplant my presidency and put Colonel Burr in the presidential chair in my place if he would agree to accommodate Federalist programs. And Burr, to his eternal discredit, flirted back with the Federalist junta, and I think discredited his character for all history. But fortunately, on the 36th ballot, the Federalists gave up, and I was implanted as president.
Yeah, with the help, no less, of someone for whom you haven't had always kind words, Alexander Hamilton.
Well, I don't know if I can say from the help of Hamilton. He wrote letters saying that I was the lesser of two evils. He called me a dishonest man, a demagogue, a Jacobin, a man too fond of democracy, and an intellectual voluptuary. But he said, in spite of all that, Jefferson is better than that scoundrel Burr. So I suppose I can give him some small credit for helping to ease the Federalist disappointment in the election.
And, of course, Burr's end would support that particular assessment, wouldn't it?
Burr, of course, has gone on to do outrageous things. We don't quite know what, but after he killed Hamilton in a duel in July of 1804, he was totally discredited, of course, and he was actually indicted in New York and New Jersey. He fled into the old Southwest, and so far as I can ascertain, the details are still murky, but he appears to have been filibustering there, essentially attempting to disengage a portion of the Southwest from the United States to form his own Napoleonic Empire. He, after all, said to his daughter Theodosia, "I will make you the Empress of Mexico by Christmas." So he was up to no good, and I think treason, and we had him tried. He was, of course, acquitted by that gloomy malignity, John Marshall, my cousin, who read the Constitution for the only time in his 35-year career, strictly to acquit this obviously guilty man.
Now, the newspapers have not been kind to you during your presidency, so let me give you a chance to at least comment one last time before you go off into retirement here. First of all, were you really too much of an admirer of the French Revolution?
No. I don't think one can admire the French Revolution too much. Never was a more important cataclysm occurring in human events, and I said rather than that revolution should have failed, I would have seen half the earth desolated if there were one Adam and one Eve alive in every nation and alive free. That would be greater than all of the despotisms of history. I stand by the revolution, including its reign of terror, a necessary bloodletting.
Why are Americans so afraid of the revolution then?
Because it was cataclysmic, and our revolution was benign in comparison. I mean, our revolution was a separation much more than a genuine revolution, and we had no ancient, illiberal, root-bound social fabric to uproot. And so we didn't have to do all of the cataclysmic things that the French rebels did in order to bring about conditions of some equality in that old world nation. I see the United States as a blank slate, a tabula rasa, and our institutions hadn't become corrupted enough to require a bloodbath.
Now, the press has also raised the specter that you may have had some children with one of your slaves, Sally Hemings.
Would you care to comment?
You're not going to comment.
None of your business.
That has been your position.
I have never responded to such filth, because to do so would require eternal vigilance. I said it's like fighting Hydra. If you cut off one head, two more spring up. And I'm not about to descend to that sort of filth. If it were true, it's none of your business. I never, ever commented upon any of these sorts of allegations.
What about the allegation that you're an atheist?
This, too, is none of your business. My religious views, whatever they are a matter between myself and my conscience, myself and my pastor, myself and my creator, but not myself and my fellow citizen. I never succumbed to this. You know, I was constantly badgered to express my own religious views. But in a free society like ours, they're no one's business but my own.
Okay. Would you comment on your experience in Paris? What was that like for an American abroad?
Well, that's easier. Living in the shadow of Dr. Franklin wasn't too easy. I said it was a school of humility. He was allowed to retire. He was an infinitely greater man than I was, a pure scientist, a great diplomat, a bon vivant, a natural aristocrat. But my work in France was essentially to increase economic possibilities for the United States in European markets. I would say I did moderately well in this regard against those difficult mercantilist conditions. Personally, France was the happiest time of my life, I believe. I fell in love with French sculpture, Houdon, French painting, Jacques-Louis David, French music, which I envy as the only thing that I envy European culture. I fell in love with Mrs. Cosway during my time in Europe, and of course I was there to watch the beginnings of the French Revolution. I will say this much more about that. Seeing the misery of the French people and the coming of the French Revolution taught me what is at stake in civilization. This must never be allowed to happen here. We must insist upon conditions of justice and equality so that we don't ever become a hierarchical, institutionally biased culture like that of France before the revolution. Voltaire was right. In France, every man is either the hammer or the anvil.
So now you retire to Monticello.
To Garden.
What do you think your life will be like there?
Well, I have a very difficult road ahead of me. My estate has been allowed to become an economic shambles. I'm deeply in debt. In fact, I leave the presidency $25,000 in debt, which is an enormous indebtedness by any standards. I don't know how I'll ever pay this off. My farms have been abused by bad overseers and neglect. Monticello, the house itself, is in a state of decay. Much building remains to be done. The house isn't finished yet, and I don't know if it ever actually will be. And I have a very grave issues to take care of, and some things that I haven't yet had a chance to do. I would quite like, before I die, to create an academy in Virginia to pass on the principles of enlightenment to our sons.
Well, I hope you have many long years to enjoy your retirement after your great service to the country and to our nation, and thank you for taking time to join us.
My deep pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to former President Thomas Jefferson, and we'll be back in a moment. You've just heard Clay Jenkinson's impersonation or performance of Thomas Jefferson, a role for which he's well known and widely acclaimed. A Rhodes Scholar who studied at Oxford University, Jenkinson is regarded as one of the most articulate public speakers available, not only on Jefferson, but also on Meriwether Lewis, John Wesley Powell, J. Robert Oppenheimer, and Sir Francis Bacon. Welcome, Clay.
Good to be here. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for joining us. What's been the public's response to your characterization of Thomas Jefferson?
Well, as I think you know, Thomas Jefferson is secular scripture in the United States. He's, in a sense, the Holy Spirit of our secular culture, and everyone quotes him. George W. Bush, William Jefferson, Clinton, Ronald Reagan. Everyone in American public life likes to find final authority for whatever is their immediate opinion in the writings of Thomas Jefferson, and for good reason. Jefferson wrote 65 volumes worth. He's the clearest writer in American history, and he's the dreamer of our national experiment. If ever a nation began with a dreamer at its center, we did with the person of Thomas Jefferson.
Now, I first heard you over 10 years ago in doing the performance, and I'm just wondering, has your presentation changed as circumstances have changed surrounding Jefferson?
Certainly, in two different ways. For one thing, I never developed a script because I believe strongly that to take someone like Jefferson and reduce him to a canned monologue of some sort would be a disservice. Here's a Renaissance man who knew paleontology and library classification and architecture and history and seven languages and wrote 22,000 letters and really was the Renaissance man of American history. So I didn't ever want to lock him in. So I continually try to learn more about his achievement and his character. But secondly, I think all historians need to keep current with the zeitgeist, and it's changed quite dramatically since I began. Jefferson is now essentially on the cross of American race. I mean, he has been crucified, historically speaking, because of his ownership of slaves, his, I would say, lukewarm abolitionist activity as a public statesman, and of course, the Sally Hemings story. And until now, race, I think, is beginning to take over the Jefferson discourse somewhat. I don't think it'll last forever, but I think we're certainly in a different period of Jefferson studies from when I began.
Now, when I asked you earlier when you were Thomas Jefferson about Hemings, you gave us Jefferson's stock line, which is no comment. Well, now you can comment. What are your thoughts on all of this that has surrounded the revelation of the DNA testing and so on?
I want to say I've always believed that it was the case. The circumstantial evidence is quite convincing, even without the DNA, and the DNA, I think, sends it over the top. There's still, say, a 1 in 100,000 chance that it isn't true, but I think we can more or less conclude that Sally Hemings was Jefferson's mistress. I am glad for this. For 200 years we've been in the did he or didn't he phase of this question. It's a fruitless question. Now that we know that it's probably true, we can begin to ask ourselves what it means, what it says about Jefferson's character. Does it make him a hypocrite? Is it another example of his famous inconsistencies? Was it a true love match, or was it some sort of exploitation bordering on what we might call rape? We don't know. And in my own website, I have a 16-point spectrum on it, rape on one end, star-crossed love on the other, and then 14 intermediary positions. And I frankly don't know, because Jefferson didn't leave documents about it, and we aren't in a position to know what sort of relationship these two human beings had, except that it lasted for more than 3 decades, produced at least 5 children. And I think in a period of that duration, there had to be an actual dynamic human relationship between a man and a woman. And race probably played less of a role in its dynamics than we like to think in retrospect.
Okay, if on a personal level it's a relationship, and on a larger level and briefly, what does it tell us about race in the years when Jefferson lived?
Well, it tells us that the Anglo tradition has always oversimplified race. I mean, this woman, Sally Hemings, was one quarter black, three quarters white, if you like those sorts of fractions. She was essentially white in appearance and black in her legal status. That tells you how pathetic our black and white dichotomies on these questions are. You know, the Spanish and the French both had much more subtle views of race dynamics than the Anglos did. And I think we have been operating according to a very crude race mythology in American history, and this invites us to take a subtler, more embracing view of it.
You also refused to comment on being called an atheist.
Jefferson was a halfway atheist, I would say. You're a better expert about this than I am. He's a deist. He believes that there is a God, but it's an absentee God, and he disbelieved in the divinity of Christ. He disbelieved in the atonement, and the Trinity, and in grace, and in sin. He disbelieved in the apocalypse, and he had serious doubts about resurrection. He certainly didn't believe in the miracles. And so Jefferson is like Schweitzer in a sense. He's searching for the historical Jesus and trying to redeem Jesus as an ethical leader, but this side of divinity. My own view is that that's a dead end. I mean, if you take a secularist view of the New Testament, you're going to find a historical Jesus, but it's not clear what you've got at the end of that journey. And I think Jefferson was probably an atheist at heart, but his timidity of spirit led him to this halfway house of Jesus as a profound ethical human being, but not the Son of God.
Well, if people want to hear you in the future, in the near future, if they want to contact you and take advantage of your wonderful performances, how do they do it?
Best thing to do would be for them to contact my website, which is th-jefferson.org. And there's a calendar there, and there is a chat room, and there are further reading recommendations and essays and so on and so forth. So that's th-jefferson.org.
Will you be doing Meriwether Lewis as the bicentennial is upon us?
Yes, Lewis was my first character, and I, of course, revived him somewhat, and I've just written a book on the character of Meriwether Lewis, and I'm doing extensive work on the Lewis and Clark expedition, largely as an Enlightenment project, the first space race in American history. But, yes, I do a first-person Meriwether Lewis, and it's not about deism, it's about grizzly bears.
Okay, well, thank you again for joining us today.
My delight.
You've been listening to Clay Jenkinson, scholar and performer, who on our show this week brought us Thomas Jefferson. This is Talking History. Thomas Jefferson, our special guest today, once wrote, "All my wishes end where I hope my days will end at Monticello." Jefferson got his wish, and here to tell you about where he lived and died is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Monticello in the Virginia Piedmont is the autobiographical masterpiece of Thomas Jefferson, designed and redesigned and built and rebuilt for more than 40 years. He described the house as his essay in architecture. Monticello is the only house in America on the United Nations prestigious World Heritage List of Sites. While visitors today often think of Monticello as an architectural masterpiece and the site of some of the most beautiful gardens in America, it was once a farm and plantation. The home and visitor center are open every day except Christmas, and the Monticello Department of Gardens and Grounds holds a series of public programs called Saturdays in the Gardens. And if you can't make it to Monticello right now, you can take a virtual tour at monticello.org.
And finally, turning to our list of coming attractions, we have one major program to call to your attention this week. Islam, Empire of Faith, will air on the public broadcasting system on May 8th. The three-hour program tells the story of the great sweep of Islamic power and faith during its first 1,000 years, from the birth of the Prophet Muhammad to the peak of the Ottoman Empire under the reign of Suleiman the Magnificent. It includes historical reenactments and a remarkable exposition of Islamic art, artifacts, and architecture, as well as interviews with historians who recount the rise of early Islamic civilization. Be sure to check your local listings for the exact showtime of Islam, Empire of Faith. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.